Welcome back, episode 122 of the Ranting Rages podcast in partnership with Inside the Rink. I'm your host, Jacob Berkowitz, and I'm alongside co-host Brett. And in this week's episode, we have on former NYR beat writer and author of the franchise New York Rangers, Rick Carpinello. We're going to be discussing the Rangers' upcoming trade deadline, Rick's book, some behind the scenes, and more. But first, just want to let you all know to go to insidetherink.com/ESPN to subscribe to ESPN Plus to watch games and more. And yeah, let's get to it. And we're back with former NYR beat writer and author of the franchise, the New York Rangers, Rick Carpinello. Rick, how's it going?
I'm well, guys. How about you guys?
Doing real well.
Good.
Real glad to have you on here. You know, before we get going, actually, I just had one kind of personal question for you. You were a reporter during the same time, actually, my uncle, Jerry Maloney, whose nickname was Haggy, was a trainer for the team. Do you happen to remember him at all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I remember. Yeah, that was a long time ago, right? He was there, what, 80s?
Yep.
Late 70s? Yeah. Absolutely. I remember him very well. Yeah. Good guy. So you must be a good guy.
I hope so. He passed a couple years ago.
Did he? I'm sorry.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. But he's the reason why, even though I've never lived in New York City, why I'm a diehard Rangers fan, because I grew up with Rangers jerseys on me as a baby because of him. So, but yeah, I'm always curious if people remember him. It seems like anyone that was around the team seemed like he was a person that made an impression. So
he was a really happy guy. I could see his smile and his curls and you know, they had a really good group back then too. And you know, some of them have just left us recently too. So a lot of memories there, a lot of memories behind the scenes, guys you'd see every day down at Playland Rink or at the other practice rinks. Good man.
Cool. Very, very cool.
So I figured we'd start with your book, The Franchise, The New York Rangers, recently released, I believe, in October, if I'm not mistaken. And I want to ask, did you have this book in mind while you were still reporting, or is this something that, you know, you decided to do after retirement or just popped into your head to do after retirement?
Yeah, I kind of had it in the back of my head for a while. I wrote two books while I was on the beat, and that was a challenge. That was very challenging. So I always thought that I might want to do another one. And as I was on the beat in the last couple of years, something would happen on the ice and it would trigger a memory for me. And when I told the other beat writers a little quip about Ty Domi or something, and they would laugh. And I was like, man, I got a million of these stories. Maybe I should put them out there somewhere. So my last couple of years, I started a Word file in my computer, and every time I thought of one of these anecdotes, I chucked it in this file. And not sure if I was going to do it, but just in case, because I knew that you can't just remember 43 years on cue. So I had that in the back of my mind, and Triumph Publishing was actually asking me to do a Rangers book for several years before I retired, and I never really wanted to do it while I was working. So when I retired and they called again and asked me to do it, and I already had the file started, I said, what the heck, I may as well do it. And it turned out I probably could have written twice as much as I wrote in the book, because I still have stories that I say, oh, I wish I'd put that one in. But there were a lot of memories for me, and I wanted to share some of them, and I shared a lot of them.
That's cool. And actually, that is kind of how it reads too, is it's, you know, while you have it broken out by kind of eras and whatnot, it does kind of have this flow of somebody that was there telling you his stories and then weaving it into the narratives of what was going on with the team and then the anecdotes that go with it too. It ends up feeling very personal in a really, really cool way. So you should be proud of what you did here. And actually, that brings up a question that we had written here with, you know, given that you've covered this team for 40 years, there were probably a lot of good stories that didn't fit into the book. Is there one or two that stand out that didn't make the cut that you would have wanted to put in?
Well, you know, I would have, in hindsight, I would have liked to have talked a little bit about the tragedy that was Mark Pavlich. I don't know if you guys are up on that, but you know, he was a really good player, he was a loner, part of the U.S. Olympic team and all. And then he had a lot of mental issues, mental health issues, as he went through life, and he ended up, you know, in some very bad places, and then he passed away. So it's tragic, but you know, it's not something you can write about in a few paragraphs, and it's not something that you know, the tone of it is kind of a downer. I mean, let's face it. And yeah. So I wasn't really sure that I wanted to put that in there, but that was like one of the stories that I wrestled with telling, and didn't. I told some of about Pavlich's play on the ice, and he was a terrific player, but didn't really get into that. And then there are probably other stories that came to mind that weren't very good, you know, weren't outstanding things that needed to be in the book, I didn't think, but certainly I got a lot of them in there, so I'm happy with that.
Yeah. So speaking of one, and it you said that, or something that broke the last, was the last straw that cost GM Craig Patrick his job, was actually drafting Brian Leetch.
Yeah.
Was it just the president that was upset at that pick? I know it's harder to get a vibe of things because there wasn't the internet in our days where NYR fans will let you know on Twitter how they're feeling about a certain pick, like the minute it happens. But did the writers, did you think it was a good pick at the time? Did it feel like the fans were like that pick at the time? Or was it just the team president that didn't like it?
You know, I think it was a culmination of, they had just been through the entire Smurfs era where they were always the smallest team on the ice. And things weren't working out. There was a lot of anxiety in the front office and among ownership that they're aiming to win and aiming to win, but never getting there, never getting across the finish line. And also they kept bumping heads in the Islanders dynasty and getting knocked out in the playoffs when they did make the playoffs. So I think there was a lot of turmoil there, and Craig Patrick was on thin ice as it was, just because he hadn't won. But I think that was the last straw. And you know, what are we doing drafting this little guy, another little skilled defenseman? And Brian, when he was in college, had a pudgy little face. He didn't look like much like an athlete. I think, you know, that was the last straw. That's amazing, right? I mean, he turns out to be the greatest player in franchise history, and he's the last straw for the general manager who, you know, in my book, I go over some of the things that he did that actually, you know, Craig Patrick actually set the foundation, and a really good foundation, for the Stanley Cup team. Yeah. I mean, he built that Stanley Cup team, and then Neil Smith put the finishing touches on it. I shouldn't say that. Neil did a lot of stuff too, a lot of really good stuff. But Craig gave them Richter and Leetch and Granato and Sandstrom, and you know, guys they traded for other pieces that they would eventually need. And then he went on to Pittsburgh, where you know, you drafted Jagr and built that team that won Stanley Cups too. So Craig Patrick is a very underrated, maybe the most underrated executive in Rangers history.
It's interesting we're talking about GMs, because one story that just kind of blew my mind was, you talk about the dart throw that the Rangers made drafting Lundqvist with their seventh round pick. And the scene that you describe is so bizarre.
Yeah.
That you know, you described that some GMs were trading away their seventh round pick just so they wouldn't have to stick around and go through the tedium of it. Well, I mean, how prevalent was that as a phenomenon? It sounds so insane to me that someone with so much interest vested in the success of the team would be like, seventh round pick. I mean, I know they often don't turn into, you know, NHL players, but there are still, you know, obviously legends found like Lundqvist there. To treat draft picks so cavalierly, or the draft itself, is just so bizarre. Like, how prevalent was that sort of attitude?
I don't know if it was prevalent. I know the Rangers did it once or twice during the Sather era. But, you know, I think a lot of the times, too, the teams have their list. And when there's nobody there left on their list that they think is worth a pick, they might trade it for a pick in the following season's draft. So, you know, there are, you see a lot of trades in the later rounds because the team's lists are dwindling and they don't really see value in taking that guy over the value of maybe having an extra pick next season. So I don't know if it's prevalent, but it happens. And it definitely happens where they just want to go because as far as their list is concerned, they're done. They're done drafting. And that really would have been some story if they'd walked away from that pick back in 2000. My gosh, what a – but, yeah, it was a great scene. You know, Don Maloney, the assistant GM, was kind of running the table there. And Glenn Sather was brand new. He'd just gotten the job on June 1st. So here he is running a draft and not really knowing his scouts, not really knowing what's out there, especially the depth of the draft. And they'd already taken a couple of goalies, I believe. And now they're out there arguing about, should we take this? You know, Christer Rockström, the European scout, is saying this is the guy to take. And they're not really sure what to do. And they don't really seem to care, you know, if they go one way or the other. So, and then Don Maloney.
Yeah, it's just, and in hindsight, it's absolutely baffling. And you're talking about the scout, the European scout, Christian Rockström.
Christer Rockström.
Christer Rockström, yes, okay. That he was nervous, like he didn't want his fingerprints on it necessarily because they're like, oh, they're not going to want to listen to me on this one anyway. Yeah. Even though he'd had tremendous success with the people that he had scouted, it seemed like he was like the guy, like they should have been going to him. You know, I don't see why there was any hesitancy at all there.
Absolutely. He was a great scout. And, you know, he's the guy who found, he and Neil Smith together found, you know, Alexei Kovalov and Sergei Zubov and Nemchinov. He did a great job through his years as a Ranger. I think he's still in the Montreal organization, if I'm not mistaken. But he's a terrific European scout. And man, can you imagine like the story? You know, Dallas was about to take him, as I wrote in the story there, that they had already taken Joel Lundqvist and they wanted to have the two brothers together and they were going to take him. And they snuck in there ahead of Dallas and took him. And, the rest is obviously history.
I can't imagine where this franchise would be without Hank.
No, and they may have never come out of the dark ages then. I mean, you know, they did put together a good team in the 2010s. You know, from 12 on for 5 years there, they were pretty darn good, and maybe as good a stretch of 5 years as franchise history since 1940 at least. But those were good teams. But how far they go without Henrik, you know, that you probably don't really look at them that way again. They did whatever they did in those game sevens because of him, and they all know it.
Yeah.
I also wonder if I cannot believe I'm blanking on his name right now to the point I'm like looking it up. Their future goalie. As of or before he had nerve damage from his shoulder in 2004, Blackburn. If he didn't get injured, Lundqvist isn't here. Like, imagine the whole change for the next two decades on what would have happened.
Possibly. I mean, but you know, They knew they were they're in the goalie market because of Blackburn's injury, obviously, but you know you also take goalies, you know, you have to draft goalies, a goalie here and there, and they had taken two in that draft, so I think it's probably safe to say that Blackburn's injury didn't really dramatically affect their need for Lundqvist, but certainly they were looking for a goalie because of Blackburn's injury. And Blackburn was good. Blackburn was good too. I mean, he was really good for a short period of time. For a young kid, he didn't care about anything. Nothing bothered him. But that was a really unfortunate injury.
How do you think this team would have played out if they had Lidstrom? Do you think Lindros. This is Lindros. Lindros. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm thinking Lidstrom because I was thinking of Neil Smith's responsibility of drafting him. And that's going to be my next question. But Lindros, how do you think the dynamic of this team would have been? Obviously, there would have been really solid pieces going the other way. But do you think this team not only wins one cup but multiple, or do you think that they might necessarily even win one?
Yeah, the way I've thought it all along is they probably don't win in 94 because of what they would have had to give up. But down the line, they probably win one or two or three with Messier and Lindros down the middle. That's pretty good. Lindros was a dominant player, an MVP type player. And then again, it depends on when Lindros gets injured, because ultimately his career is cut short and certainly altered by the concussions. But I think it would have been hard for them to win 93, 94 minus Kovalov and Monty or whatever weight, whatever it would have been to give up to get him. But I think having Lindros and Messi eventually would have led to at least one, maybe two, maybe three cups.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people forget, just because how his career ended up turning out, just how much of a tour de force Lindros was when he was playing. It's just absolutely unreal.
Yeah.
And he's the kind of player, like, for him, I also wish it for Bure as well, that they would have been able to play in an era that actually tried to protect players and didn't just allow vicious headshots and things like that. That really, and also the hooking and holding that kept those kind of guys. I mean, I think Lindros in today's NHL is competing for a heart, you know?
Yeah. And he won a heart. He won at least one heart, as I think. I'm pretty sure, but he was a guy who had to put up with a lot, obviously. I mean, you know, Jeff Bukaboom used to just beat him to a pulp as much as he could. I mean, how much can you beat the guy to a pulp? He's gigantic. And he was mean too. I mean, we used to say about Lindros that he commits a penalty every shift, but they can't call it every shift. And so he was a mean, tough guy too, but so skilled and fast, and obviously gigantic. He would have been a force in any era. I always, you mentioned the hooking, holding and things, and people say, today's game, the guys are more skilled than they are. They are. The guys today are bigger, faster, stronger, and more hand skilled, I think, than the guys of past eras. But isn't it amazing that the highest scoring era in hockey was when guys were tackling, could tackle you? Wayne Gretzky scored all those points with guys on his back, with sticks stuck in his jersey. And there were interference. I mean, never mind when you have the puck, they wouldn't let you get to open ice because they were allowed to interfere with you. It's incredible that those two things lined up, that kind of play and that kind of scoring were at the same time. Now, I guess obviously the goalies were less evolved. There wasn't the butterfly technique and the gigantic, gigantic pads that they wear now. I think, still absurd that the amount of padding they wear under their jerseys and the size of their trapper gloves. And I think the equipment is absurdly huge. But if it wasn't, what would the scores of the games be? You know, if
oh my God, yeah.
Right, if those guys, one timer.
Yeah. Can you imagine what these guys would do today, what Connor McDavid would do playing against a guy with John Davidson's pads? They would have no chance. So the games would be 8-7, 10-12, 10-12 goals each.
I'm pretty sure a goalie would want to retire after one game.
And those guys weren't athletic. They didn't have the techniques that today's goalies have, and they weren't as athletic necessarily. Well, that started to change in the Mike Richter era. He was a real athletic guy, and but back then, goalies were stand up, stay on your feet, wait for the slap shot and react. And sometimes they had the old pad stack that they called it, when they'd slide it sideways and stack their pads. And, that kind of technique couldn't possibly work today. Couldn't possibly.
No. Although it is, I do love how anytime a goalie does, positionally does do a double pack save, Valiquette always just loves that. He always, and he's like, look at it. Look at the old 80s. That's that. He gets such a kick out of it.
He does. He enjoys it. I'm sure the old goalies that are watching are smiling too.
Yeah, absolutely.
But not the Michigan, though. Not the Michigan. Not the Michigan. Not a fan of the Michigan.
No. You know what? It's a tremendously skilled play, but I don't know, man.
Yeah.
If I was a goalie and somebody pulled that on me, I would have been mad. I would have been annoyed.
I don't even feel like
it showed up.
Go hex on them. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I'm a ice hockey goalie. I would just props, because I don't know what I'm doing at that point. They say to keep on like to hug the post as much as you can, like bring your shoulder up, like to where the post and crossbar meet. After that, good luck.
Yeah.
That's probably what any goaltending instructor is going to tell anyone, because it's just, it's just such a skilled play that you just got to tip your hat at that.
Yeah, but in the old days, you'd hug the post standing. You wouldn't hug the post down on your knees.
Well, could you even get away with that in the old days? Someone would murder you on the ice.
That too. But yeah, you wouldn't. You know, the old goalies would stand against the post and cover everything. And if you were going to pull a Michigan, you'd have to go low. You wouldn't be able to go high.
Yeah.
But of course, nobody could do the Michigan back then. And way back when they had flat sticks, you couldn't even lift the puck onto your stick. So,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I do want to get into some current Rangers questions for you, but I have one last one. Does retirement offer you a different perspective as a writer than it did as an active beat reporter? Like, do you feel more you're able to speak more freely now that you no longer have to rely on the organization? Do your job effectively? Does it change how you watch the games? Can you just talk about that a little bit?
I don't watch the games as critically. So there's that. Certainly try to stay off social media during the games, unless I have something I feel is important to say. The best part for me is that I can DVR the game and watch it a half hour later and skip through all the gambling commercials.
So, there you go.
So that's the best part. I don't have to work during the game. You know, when you're on the beat, and especially when you're working for a newspaper, you're writing throughout the game and your head's down a lot, and you rely on the instant replay screen quite a bit because you miss things. Now I don't feel like I miss anything while I'm watching the game. I can see everything. I don't have my head down in my laptop and I'm not trying to spin a story in my head while the game's going on. I'm just enjoying it and maybe trying to figure out what time I'm going to get to bed.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's probably a more enjoyable way to watch that game, I imagine.
It really is, with my feet up and a sweatshirt on and maybe a sandwich or something. It's definitely it's way better.
Nice.
It's a lot easier. Nice. It's a lot less stressful, for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So going on to the current Rangers trade deadline, is there anyone you believe the Rangers will acquire before the trade deadline?
And that's coming right up, right? Friday, I think. That shows you how far removed I am. But normally, for 40-something years, the trade deadline was a day when I would get up early in the morning and sit in front of my computer I shouldn't say 40-something years, only since the internet was born. And I'd sit in front of my computer from 8 a.m. till 6 p.m. and not move. So now I don't even have to worry about it. I think that, Frank Vetrano is probably, and it's, I'm sure it's been mentioned a lot, is a guy that they'll look at. And that type of player, they need to find somebody to play on that first line, the first line, which is actually the second line now, because any line with Panarin on it is the first line. But the Zibanejad-Kreider line badly needs somebody. And they don't have that person. That person's not in the organization right now. If they're going to be serious about making a run, that line has to produce. And they kind of need a guy who will shoot it and can make a play so Zibanejad can shoot it. Zibanejad is now a playmaker, and they need him to be a goal scorer too. So obviously that's a hole I think they need to fill. Whether they can actually fill it with somebody who's an upgrade, and I think Vetrano is a bit of an upgrade, but I don't think he's, you know, he's certainly not what they were hoping to get last year out of Patrick Kane or what they did get out of Tarasenko. But he's that's the type of player I think they need to acquire and the type of player I think they will acquire. The cost is going to be questionable. I think if they trade Kako for Vetrano, I think that's a lousy deal. But they may do it. And, then, you know, with this owner, with the edict to win, they may do something drastic like that.
That actually brings up a question that we had already was, what is your opinion on Kaapo Kakko? You know, he hasn't been playing with consistent 5v5 producing center this season. Do you think that he is part of the Rangers' future plans? And that, and I'm kind of surprised that you think he actually would be actually on the table for somebody like a Frank Vetrano rental.
Well, I'm sure they'll ask for him. You know, there's no question that any team that trades with the Rangers in an attempt to, for them to get a top line player is going to want Kakko. Whether they do that or not, I don't know. I don't know what their view of him is. You know, honestly, behind, you know, Chris Drury plays it pretty close to the vest. I don't, and I'm not around them at all anymore. So I don't know what their view of him is. I think it's crazy to trade him for a rental. Absolutely crazy. And, but on the other hand, I'm not as high on him as I was. You know, he's had some opportunities here to play top line minutes. And even though they're brief, he has not produced. He hesitates to shoot the puck. He defers to his line mates. He's really good along the wall. He's pretty good defensively, but they need him to be a goal scorer or at least an offensive player. And he's not that. I think he's a real good third line player. And if that's how you see him, if you see him as a third line player, then maybe you do give him up for Vetrano. I still think he's just a slowly developing player who has potential to be a top six guy at some point in his career. He's not that now.
Is there one team in particular that worries you versus the Rangers in the playoffs?
I think, you know, Florida for sure, Carolina. You guys got a fire going or something?
In my background, apparently. I hope if my building would notify me, that'd be great, but I don't know. We'll see.
There we go.
Okay. I thought I was in trouble. I thought I did something wrong. I think that, you know, the teams – did you see the game against Toronto the other night in Toronto? That's that kind of game where the neutral zone is basically an easy pass for both teams. Rangers love that. And if the Rangers play a team like Toronto, they'd have a very good chance, I would think. But if they play a team that shuts down the neutral zone like Carolina does, or a team that's going to ground and pound like Florida, they're going to have problems. And I think they're going to have big problems. Even, I hate to say this, but even a team like the Islanders will just clog them up a little bit. And they don't adjust well to that. Their players are, as we know and as we've said ad nauseum, they're east-west guys. They're not north-south. They don't handle the neutral zone very well when it gets clogged. They don't adjust and dump pucks in and go forecheck. They don't do the things you need to do against a trapping or clogging team. So any team that presents that kind of a defensive play in the neutral zone is going to give them trouble. Any team that lets them skate, and they'll let the other team skate too, like Toronto, where they can play easy pass through the neutral zone, I think they have got a great chance. But it's going to be interesting to see how they adjust. Now, you know, in the last 2 years with Gerard Gallant, they did not adjust in the playoffs. And even though they got to a conference final, they did not make adjustments. It'll be interesting to see how Peter Laviolette, with his playoff experience, does adjust. And if he can get these horses to play a different style, because they're going to have to, depending on the opponent.
Gotcha. I'd like to transition to some of the history, some of the famous stuff that had happened in recent history with the Rangers here as your reporter. One of them I'm just curious of, did you think that the Rangers were going to get Jack Eichel?
No, I didn't. Because at the time, Zibanejad was becoming a force, and they were going to have to sign him. So they weren't going to be able to afford Eichel. And also, I thought it would have been, you know, even though he turned out to be a great player for Vegas, he's not a, he was a huge risk coming back from that neck surgery, I thought. Yeah. And I think the Rangers thought that too. So they certainly at the start were in it when he was being bandied about. The Rangers were certainly in it. But as the reality set in terms of the salary cap and in terms of his surgery, I think they dropped out pretty quickly.
Okay.
I know we just said we're going back to more recent history. I just wanted to mention this one thing because it just actually came up that Elliot Friedman just said the Rangers did ask about Alex Tuch. Is that someone that you would say would probably could fit on that top right winger spot with Kreider and Mikko with his style of play?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, I would assume he would fit nicely. And he's certainly got a playoff style game. I'm not, because I'm removed now, so I'm not really, I don't have my web of league knowledge around me anymore. I don't actually know what kind of season he's having. So I hate to sound ignorant, and I won't go into too much depth, and I won't lie. So I don't really know what kind of season he's having, but he's certainly, from what I remember, he's certainly the type of player that would fit nicely. Again, do you guys know what kind of season he's having? I don't.
To be honest, I thought he was having a very good season. I thought he was injured, but I might have mistaken it for last year.
I think he did miss some time. Yeah, he did.
Yeah. I think he's still producing quite well.
Yeah, he has 40 points in 55 games.
Yeah.
I thought he'd be the perfect player. It's just that I believe, what is he from Buffalo, or he just really loves Buffalo or something like that? I don't remember what it was. I don't know. It's just normally when you have those type of players in those franchises, whether it's Buffalo, Columbus, or all that, you don't, you know, give them up so easily because it's not as common for someone to say, I want to play here the rest of my career. Yeah. And, you know, so I don't know.
I imagine the cost would be pretty high, though. And it would be young players and draft picks. And, you know, Buffalo's one of those teams that's in a forever rebuild, along with Ottawa and a few others. They're just always rebuilding, and they never get there. So I'm certain that would require quite a bit of capital to get a guy like that.
Yeah, I would think so. I feel like we never really got the full story, and I just wonder if you could provide any insight into the history of the buyout of Tony DeAngelo and the incident with Georgiev.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about that pretty well in the book. Not well, but pretty extensively in the book. Tony, he was a good player. Tony's, first and foremost, a very highly skilled player, a very competitive player, and a tough, tough kid. But as you know, he had some history in his background where he said things he shouldn't have said. He was on some social media sites where he said things he shouldn't have said. And he was on a short leash. When he got to the Rangers, he had a couple more incidents where, you know, they sat him down for disciplinary reasons. And he was on a three strikes and you're out. He was on the third strike. So the game against Pittsburgh goes to overtime, and Georgiev gives up a goal to Crosby, I believe, on the 3-on-3. And DeAngelo turns around and swears at him and tells him to make a bleeping save. And Georgiev is the nicest kid you want to meet, but he has a lot of Henrik in him when it comes to his competitiveness. He did not react to that very well. And as they got in the tunnel toward the locker room, he and DeAngelo got close to each other, and Georgiev punched him. And I heard that he landed it too. In a fight, I like DeAngelo over Georgiev, but Georgiev's got all his equipment on, first of all, and second of all, it got broken up pretty quickly by Kreider and company. So Georgiev got the punch in, and that was strike three for Tony. and it's not, you can't say that he doesn't have, hadn't had his chances, but he's been in a lot of organizations now in a really short period of time. This is not something this is not a one-off that happened in New York.
It's a different and better situation considering the players and all that, but it reminds me of when in Ottawa in 2017, I don't remember what game it was game two or game five, where Stepan came back and Henrik was really mad. Yeah. It was in the playoff series versus Ottawa, and he went back to him, like, the balls that he had to go back there and like put his hands up saying relax. Like, I like living. I wouldn't have done that, but
I don't think Henrik took serious guts. I don't think Henrik enjoyed that very much. That he doesn't like being told to calm down, and you will not meet a more competitive person than that guy. But he was, he didn't need to be told to calm down at any point. He did not want to hear that.
Is there anything you could tell us about the infamous Tom Wilson incident? Obviously that went down in a way that there were not really any repercussions. And could you take us through, so what was the vibe like in the locker room or, around the place during that time?
Yeah, it was, that was, and I think I've mentioned, I think I wrote it this way, the most cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs era or piece of an era that I've ever covered, because not only obviously is Tom Wilson doing what he's doing to Panarin and Buchnevich, but you've got Gorton and Davidson about to be fired, the Rangers being eliminated from the playoffs the following night, the Rangers' response to that when they played Washington again a couple nights later, and just the game was just fight after fight after fight by players who don't fight, by the way, the Colin Blackwells and Ryan Stroms of the world. That was just a nutty time. And the Wilson thing certainly played a part in Davidson and Gorton getting fired, and the owners saying basically they're not tough enough and they haven't made enough progress, and blowing up the entire, or just ending the entire rebuild program. It was a culmination of all of that, with Tom Wilson in the middle, and the fact that the league did nothing really exacerbated things too, because as you recall, Dolan had that letter written and tweeted about George Parros being incompetent or overmatched or whatever words he used. Davidson and Gorton didn't even know about that. One of their kids saw it on social media and told them. They had no idea that was coming out. So that blindsided them. Yeah, that blindsided them. And you talk about nutty times, boy. That was just, David Quinn's the coach, and I think personally that he did a really good job in terms of what he was brought in to do, aside from the record. But he knows he's on his last legs there pretty much. And when those guys get fired, he's sure of it. But his guys come to the forefront and battle the next time they play against Wilson's team. You can't even put into words how nutty that 4 or 5 day period really was. It just come off too. They had just come off being shut out by the Islanders in a game that sent them to the brink of elimination. So all of that stuff combined, along with the usual nuttiness of the owner of the Rangers, really made it quite a chapter.
I had heard that Dolan was generally kind of more hands off with the Rangers and kind of let the GM, let the president run the team as it was, but that incident got him way more involved with the team. Is that a fair assessment in your view?
Yeah, I think that, I've said this before too. Glenn Sather built the Edmonton dynasty, coached it, was the GM, had some unbelievable luck. I mean, he gets Wayne Gretzky without A, drafting him, or A, trading for, or B, trading for him. He get, you know, he just has Wayne Gretzky. So, yeah. But you know, all kudos. He won 5 Stanley Cups in Edmonton. He went into the Hockey Hall of Fame as a builder. Just unbelievable resume. But I still say the greatest thing he's ever done was keeping Dolan away from the Rangers. And that was his, that was the biggest thing he ever did as the GM of the Rangers, was keeping the owner at bay. Once Sather, you know, retired, and I think it was easier for Dolan to get involved with John Davidson and Jeff Gorton. And that's certainly what he did. And also he had Sather whispering in his ear at the end there. You know, I wrote about how Sather suggested they hire Mike Babcock and to replace David Quinn, and how Gorton and Davidson thought it's not the right team for that. It's not the right time for a guy who's better off with veterans. And that kind of ticked off Dolan too. But I think that Sather was so powerful in Dolan's ear that he could have said, "Don't fire Davidson and Gorton," and Dolan would not have fired them. I think anything that Sather suggested or pleaded for, Dolan would have gone along with that. And so I think Sather's fingerprints certainly were on the firings of Davidson and Gorton also, even in a passive way, if it was a passive way. If he wanted to prevent that, I think he could have prevented it, and he didn't.
Gotcha. Some good insight there. A lot of that was just kind of like rumors and stuff that I'd heard swirling around before, so it's nice to have some verification on that, because that is kind of the impression that a lot of fans got too, is this feels Sather-y.
Yeah. and then, you know, before the, you know, Chris Drury takes over and before David Quinn gets fired, Sather is in the exit meetings with the players at the end of the season. So, you know, here's a guy who's a retired guy. He's a consultant or whatever his title was at that time. And he's in the players' exit meetings. So,
yeah,
that, you know, he was certainly involved there.
Yeah. Got a couple more questions here. I want to wrap up. I do just have to ask you about Tortorella. Just, he's such an interesting figure in hockey in general. And in the book you wrote that you were, you actually got to know him earlier in his career when he was a lot different personally. Did that early relationship, did that help you later on when he was with the Rangers and a much more combative media, especially with the media?
Yes, it certainly did. I still text with him once in a while and,
oh, yeah.
We do. We have a good relationship. When he was an assistant coach, he was a different human being. He was only here 1 year in that role, and then he was the interim coach for the last, 4 games of 99-2000. But it helped in that he wasn't as aggressive with me in press conferences. And I actually got a chance to, you know, occasionally go talk to him one-on-one in his office or somewhere else that other guys didn't get. It didn't do me any good, honestly. He wasn't going to tell me anything that was a printable. But I did have a different relationship with him. He didn't bark at me as much, and although he did once in a while. And then there was a time there too where I sat in his office with him and I said to him, why do you act like this? You know, I think it was after he had really gone after Sam Rosen in a post-game press conference. I'm like, Sam's a legend here. Why do you treat him like that? Like, even if you don't like the question, why can't you be respectful? You know, and we started going back and forth on it. And I said, look at Tom Coughlin. Okay, Tom Coughlin was the biggest hard ass you ever want to meet, and he changed. He changed his personality on purpose and won 2 Super Bowls. Like, do you not see that, John? You know, and he's like, he goes, I know. He goes, but I got to be me. I'm like, but this isn't really not who you are. This is like, and then he got mad because he thought I was saying it's an act. but that's really not who he is. You know, when you get him away from the ice, that's not who he is. On the ice, that is who he is. And he was not about to change. I think he softened a little bit in Philly, but
yeah, you know, it seems
that. Yeah, you still get the YouTube clips once in a while of him. Like, there's the one guy that he banned, right? That he won't answer any of his questions.
They capitalized on that with a gritty earmuffs commercial or earphones commercial, where during a press meeting, and they had Gritty kind of play as just like younger, like they said he's basically younger and shouldn't hear, like, you know, curses and all that. And every time John Turturro went off on one of the media people, they said, put on your earmuffs and we'll let you know when to take them off. Like that was like, I obviously not fan of Philly, but that was top tier commercial. That's awesome.
But yeah, I mean, so he hasn't changed that much, but I do think in general, he's more available. He's more amenable. And again, I don't see all of his press conferences, and you only see the bad ones. you only see when he goes off. But I do think he's softened a little bit.
Yeah, it does. I would agree with that. Yeah, it does seem like he's calmed down a little bit. Yeah. I always just remember his rant in the Winter Classic that got him fined, and you discussed that in the book as well, where he kind of speculated that the refs, you know, or the league were really wanting that game to go into overtime. Right. Do you think that was just an angry outburst, or do you think he genuinely believes that that's something that would be possible? And do you have any personal opinion on game management by officials?
I do. I don't know. I don't know if he actually believed that. I know he was mad at the call. I don't think he or any of the players thought that that should have been a penalty shot at the end of that Winter Classic. Danny Briere and Lundqvist, of course, stopped it to remain undefeated outdoors, or to start his outdoor career undefeated. I think he was just angry at the officials for making that call at that time. That said, I've over the years had plenty to say over. I don't mind when the officials miss a call, or if they make an incorrect call. That doesn't bother me that much, because that happens, and it's a fast game, and they're going to miss things. No question about it. I get annoyed when they make a call based on the score or the time of the game. And more importantly, when they, you know, we always say they have marbles in their pocket and they're counting which team has X amount of power plays at this point, and so who gets the next one. And that annoys the hell out of me. I don't think any game should be officiated that way. I also got annoyed, like, just today, where I see people complaining about the slash on Connor Bedard and how the Rangers have to how the NHL has to protect its stars. I think that's a bunch of bullcrap. They have to protect everybody, not the stars. I mean, you know, if a third line guy gets whacked in the hand and breaks his hand, he needs to be protected too. And I don't think they do a good job of protecting anybody, given the referee's inability or unwillingness to make a critical, correct call. And of course, it's a joke. The Department of Player Safety, it really is comical at this point how they don't seem to give a crap about player safety. And if they wanted to get rid of this stuff, you could do it in a couple of months. You could get rid of it for sure. But they don't. And I understand their hands are tied by the collective bargaining agreement, by the GMs who don't want players suspended. You know, there's a reason for every loophole that they use to get out of suspending somebody. That's, you know, it's all money driven too. So but it's not a Department of Player Safety if it won't suspend Tom Wilson for trying to chop Pavel Buchnevich's head off. You know, that's not. And I think, you know, as recently as Saturday in Toronto, you know, Rempe leaves his feet and goes head first into this kid in Toronto and knocks him out basically with a head injury. Yeah. Maybe it was reviewed, but it doesn't get anything. Not even one of those joke fines. So I don't think they do a very good job of player safety, and that, and that's, so yeah, I could go on for about 2 hours with this.
Yeah, we've had times where we go like 30 minutes and just talking about this, we're like, oh, it's been 30 minutes. That's like 50% of our podcast. And all we do is discuss the player safety, how they're not cracking down on this stuff.
Yeah.
And so one final question. Again, thank you for your time. What is your confidence level for this team this year in regards to making a run or actually finally winning the cup since 1994?
I do think they're a contender for sure. I think they're a team that a lot of teams don't want to see because of their goalie and B, because of their power play. And I think that I don't think there's a team that they couldn't beat 4 out of 7. There will not be a team in the playoffs that they could not beat 4 out of 7. I think it's going to be a really tall task for them to beat 4 teams 4 out of 7, especially playing different styles of games, especially the way they struggle scoring at 5-on-5, and especially the way they sometimes get lackadaisical defensively. It's hard for me to see them being consistent enough for 2 months to actually get to a Stanley Cup final. But again, I don't see – there aren't a lot of teams out there that I say, well, that team's going to win 4 series. I don't see any team that stands out far and away ahead of the Rangers. So I know I'm hedging a lot here, but they, you know, I think they're legit contenders. I think they're a team that – teams will definitely be concerned about playing, but I don't also envision a parade in the Canyon of Heroes in June. I think that's pretty much of a stretch at this point.
Yep, fair assessment.
Thank you, Rick, so much for your time. Before we go, would you like to let everyone know where they could buy the franchise New York Rangers book?
Thanks. Well, first, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. Not very relevant anymore, so I don't get a chance to talk hockey very much. So I appreciate your time. The book is available anywhere where you buy books, Barnes & Nobles, on Amazon.com, and, of course, at Triumph Books. So anywhere you buy books, you can get my book. And I appreciate the time you've given me to put out a little advertisement for this, and thanks for having me and let me talk.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's absolutely our pleasure. And it's a great read. We'll definitely be recommending it to everyone. So we appreciate you very much coming on. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thanks.